Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, imagine being overwhelmed by profound fatigue for months on end. Then mix in joint pain, memory problems, headaches, maybe even some flu-like symptoms. If you've got chronic fatigue syndrome, you'll recognise these symptoms. It's a debilitating condition, but it's one that's often hard for doctors to diagnose. It's known as chronic fatigue syndrome, but also known more these days as myalgic encephalomyelitis. It's estimated that about 1% of Australia's population, that's about 250,000 people, suffer from it. Of those, maybe 60,000 are unable to either leave their bed or their home. Now, there have been many theories over the years about what causes disorder, and I think much ignorance as well. Researchers have been unable to come up with any really effective treatment. Joining me tonight are Dr. Heidi Nicol, who's the chief executive at Emerge Australia, a charitable organisation that lobbies on behalf of chronic fatigue syndrome patients. Heidi, terrific to have you in and welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. Also joining us, researcher Professor Paul Fisher, who's head of microbiology at La Trobe University. Paul, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Philip. Well, thanks for having me.
Terrific to have you with us. And also joining us is Fiona Cheng, who can tell us all what it's like to actually have the condition and what it's like to live with chronic fatigue syndrome. Fiona, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you with us there. If we turn your microphone on, everything would be much better.
Even better.
Heidi, there's a huge range of symptoms that people have with ME/CFS. We'll call it that because otherwise it's a tongue twister. Mm-hmm. It's a lot more than just feeling tired, isn't it?
Yeah.
What are the symptoms?
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing to say is that it's a very complex chronic condition. And as you said, there is a big range of symptoms, but a lot of people have a lot of things in common. So they would be things like problems with sleeping, cognitive problems like an inability to concentrate or major problems with memory. Some people have problems synthesizing information or processing information that's going in. A lot of people have orthostatic intolerance, and that's an inability to tolerate standing up for long periods of time, and it's something to do with their heart rate. A lot of people have pain, flu-like symptoms, headaches, sore throats and swollen glands. At the most severe end of the spectrum, people can have a really significant sensitivity to light and sound. Mm. But the most important thing that I should say on the symptoms is the cardinal symptom that every patient with ME/CFS has is something called post-exertional malaise. And what that means is that if the patient does too much, if they use too much energy, then all of those symptoms get worse.
Mm. It's called a syndrome, chronic fatigue syndrome. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, as an initial question, is it a thing, or is it just a descriptor of the things that people who have this condition feel? So, in other words, it's not like having a flu virus, for example.
Okay, so,
which is a thing you can look at through a microscope.
So, to answer the question on is it a thing, I'll come back to something that you said earlier on, which is about diagnosis being difficult, because that's a bit of a misnomer. Actually, diagnosis is not that difficult. It's just that doctors don't know what they're looking for. So, where we are now with ME/CFS is that internationally there is a good degree of consensus with a tight diagnostic criteria. So, if you go to the Emerge Australia website, we have these diagnostic criteria listed. And we're also just launching some GP education, which is bringing together the international consensus about what makes this thing that's ME/CFS. Mm. So the most important thing is that you have to have this central symptom of post-exertional malaise, which is when all of the symptoms get worse.
Because why it's hard to diagnose, I imagine, is because all of the things you describe could easily be associated with other illnesses or maladies, couldn't they?
So post-exertional malaise is...
No, apart from that point. Yeah.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And that's why that is the central cardinal symptom. Mm-hmm. So the way that it's diagnosed is that there's kind of a chart, and it says, first of all, the patient has to experience this thing called post-exertional malaise. And that's an indication that they're not producing the energy which most of us can produce that fuels all of our day-to-day activities. Mm-hmm. So if you start off with not being able to fulfill those energy requirements, and then you, in addition to that, you have a range of these symptoms. So you might have the orthostatic intolerance, you might have the pain, you might have the sore throats, the headaches, etc., and neurological symptoms. If you have enough of those things, and, you know, as I say, I'm not a medical doctor, I'm a doctor of something else, but it's all listed there and doctors can look it up. And what we need is for doctors to be more knowledgeable about those diagnostic criteria, because it isn't that hard, and it is definitely its own thing. It's a syndrome, yes. So it's not that there's no diagnostic blood test.
There's no simple test you can do.
There's no simple test. So that is a big problem. And in conjunction with the fact that there's no diagnostic test that's easy to do, it means that we really do need doctors to be very clear about the diagnostic criteria, so that we're not just putting people that are tired or people that are getting frequent sore throats into this category. Any CFS is very much its own thing, and its doctors need to know about it.
Yeah, and also, you know, we're comfortable with these kinds of approaches in other areas, aren't we? I mean, a diagnosis of, for instance, autism, for example, is there's no test for it, but it's diagnosed through a series of behaviours, which may lead doctors to conclude that, you know, that this particular condition is present.
Exactly. And I think that's an example of something which has had increasing awareness, and people are much more aware of that now. Doctors are more aware of it, and doctors know that they need to go out and educate themselves if they don't know the diagnostic criteria for those kind of conditions. And that's really where we're a little bit behind with ME/CFS, but we're doing the best that we can to change that.
All right, Fiona, how long did it take you to get diagnosed?
Oh, from the time I first got obviously really ill with it, it was several years, but that was a very long time ago. Mm-hmm. So I felt obviously very ill in my early 20s, and I'm 58, so I've been sick for a number of decades, frankly. Mm-hmm. And when I understood the illness...
You've had it pretty much continuously since then.
Yeah, I have. Yeah. And when I understood the illness, I looked back and realised I'd actually probably started it when I was 15, so that we're up for kind of a really long time, like 42 years.
Yeah.
Because it was the mid-80s when I first became really ill, it was even less known about it than it is now. And
I bet that's right. Did you suffer resistance?
I definitely did.
Said, look, why don't you just pull yourself together?
Yeah, those were the days of yuppie flu, if you can remember that far, when that's what it was called. And so, which was very patronising and very much, you know, I know you're just making it up, which is not true. And a friend told me about it, and I actually went to my doctor and said, I think I've got this. And he, I actually told him about it, and I went to see
another... Did the doctor know about that?
No. And I, not long after that, moved and saw the next doctor. She was an older woman, and I told her about it, and she said, oh, look, I've never heard that given a name, but I have seen it in my practice over the years. People who get ill with certain things and they never seem to get better, and their lives are very affected by that.
Describe your symptoms for us.
Look, at different times, because it's such a long time, different times there have been different symptoms, but the most common thing, really they've varied into severity. I've had years and years where I couldn't really leave the couch or the bed. I'd just get up to go to the bathroom and then kind of go back to bed. I was studying full-time when I became very ill. In my early 20s, I had to pull out of study slowly but surely, because I just couldn't concentrate. I was trying to get all the information in, it just was not staying there. I had very bad temperature regulations. I remember once lying in bed, it was about 40 degrees in an air-conditioned house in Newtown, and I was freezing. I had multiple blankets on me. My whole body just seemed to be breaking down and unable to kind of control itself or regulate itself, and I didn't really understand why. But that's continued very much. Very large sensory overload. I've had years where I couldn't go into a supermarket, because you go into supermarkets and there's information grabbing at you all, you know, which we all sort of know a bit, but we can all block it out. But I couldn't do that, so I couldn't shop for years.
You see, listeners should know that you're a mum with three kids.
Yes.
And you're married. How's that?
That has been really, really, really hard.
How's that gone down for you?
Well, it was just after I got married that I got really sick. So my poor husband has been stuck with me ever since. He couldn't get out of it after that. Look, having the children was incredibly hard, but I was determined to do it. I was married at 22 and didn't have my children till almost 40, and part of that was hoping that I'd get better, and I never did, and I had to realise I had to either do it in the state I was in or I'd never be able to do it. It was incredibly, incredibly hard and probably almost killed me. I also managed to go to university in that time. It took me a really long time.
Oh, so you've done almost nothing, have you?
Yeah. Well, considering the last sort of 42 years, yes, I've gone to university and I've been married. I've never been able to work at the job that I was trying to do. I studied landscape architecture at university. I've never been able to be a landscape architect. I've never been able to work more than part-time. I can't work in the morning or do anything in the morning. So throughout my children's schooling, my husband has had to get up and get them out the door to school every morning because it's a classic chronic fatigue syndrome thing to not be able to get up very well in the morning. So basically I've been married to someone quite remarkable and who's been willing to do that. He puts a triple shot latte next to my bed every morning and it's the only way that I ever get out of bed.
Really?
Yeah. And he goes to work and puts it there and I just wake up when I can and I drink it and that propels me. I have to wait till it actually kicks in.
And then suddenly you're an energizer bunny, are you?
Yeah. Well, yeah, for at least 10 minutes, yeah. I know it sounds on paper like I've done things, but they've been very hard and there's been an enormous amount not done. A lot of, things I haven't gone to with him, things I haven't done with my children, things I haven't been able to...
Can you travel? Could you go to another city for a weekend, for example?
Oh, I did actually go to Melbourne for a couple of weeks ago. I lived there for a time with my husband. But it just writes me off for days and weeks afterwards. A few years ago, we thought we were losing a house because we didn't have the money. It's another thing about chronic fatigue. People can't work. And in a city like Sydney that's so expensive, usually both people have to work in a partnership and I can hardly work. And so I thought, okay, and I got all kind of psyched up and I got a job 3 days a week and I did it for a month and I was felt so ill from the first day and I eventually had to say to them, I'm sorry, I can't do it, and I went to bed for 3 months. So that's the kind of impact.
You didn't get out of bed for 3 months?
I didn't get out of bed for 3 months after working 1 month for 3 days a week.
Wow. What does that do to the rest of your health?
It's really terrible. I have a whole lot of other illnesses and come about because you can't, it's hard to exercise because you have to, because, just like Heidi said, like post-exertion malaise means that you do too much. And so I can walk the dog around the block really slowly, but then I can't do that again for a number of days. Everything is risk management and management of, how much people energy you have. And if I do this, I can't do that for the next 2 days. And so I did almost nothing today. I basically sat in the sun in the garden.
Yeah, I was going to say, how will you be at the end of this interview?
I'll be okay because I did almost nothing today.
Right.
And that was really good. But that was on purpose. That was to prepare for this. And tomorrow's flexible. I'm doing something, but if I can't do it, that's okay.
Okay.
And that's what it requires from everyone in your life, them understanding that you can't do the things that...
I think one of the things that sort of struck me when I was speaking to Fiona in preparation for this was that you were a law student, weren't you, Fiona? Mm. So if you think about going back to all of those, 40-odd years ago, Fiona should be sitting in front of you now as a practicing lawyer, and she would have been in a dual partnership with her husband, having her kids when she wanted to have her kids in her mid-20s. She would have been a successful lawyer. She's a smart, capable woman, clearly, but has been managing this really serious chronic condition for all of these years and is, in just an entirely different situation than she should have been. So I really just think that it's worth marking that.
Absolutely. Ingrid's text is saying those of us diagnosed with MS suffer debilitating fatigue. Please, please raise this. I think we have, Ingrid. I think we've put that down as a marker. Di from Canberra also a sufferer as well. Craig, I will ask you a question, but I'll put it to Paul Fisher. Now, Professor Paul Fisher is head of microbiology at La Trobe University in Melbourne. He's also part of our discussion tonight. Paul, you've been researching the biological causes of chronic fatigue syndrome. What have you found? Are there any?
There are certainly biological causes, although we don't actually know exactly what they are yet, if you want to go back to the primary cause. We've been trying to understand the mechanism of the disease, and someone mentioned the debilitating fatigue that is characteristic of the disease, as well as the post-exertional malaise. And that has meant that people have thought, well, maybe there's something wrong with the cell's energy-producing capabilities. And that goes down to these tiny little compartments that we all have in all of our cells called mitochondria. They have little membranes around them, and they are responsible for the last steps in oxidizing our food molecules. And in the process, they store some of that energy that in the form of a charge difference across the membrane, like a little battery. And then they use that to make, convert that energy into a usable form for the rest of the cell called ATP. Mm-hmm. So people have thought, well, maybe there's a problem with the cell's energy producing apparatus. And so we went in and had a look at that, and we discovered, in fact, that that is the case.
Okay.
There are a series of five protein complexes that do this process in the membranes of the mitochondria. And we found that the last one, which is imaginatively called complex 5, is the one that actually makes the fuel for the rest of the cell, has an inefficiency built into it in chronic fatigue cells that are not in control cells.
Okay.
And then what happens is that the rest of the cell senses that problem and tries to make up for it. So we have found that the cell turns up all of its energy-producing pathways to try to make up for that inefficiency. But that only brings the energy production back to normal levels in the resting cell. And so we think that maybe what is happening is that that means that the cell can't answer the call for more energy when it comes, because it's already got everything fully turned on just to mark time.
Mm. Yeah, okay. It can't be picked. So, I mean, well, just to return to this, what you're saying is that that might be a descriptor of what's happening in the cells, but what's causing it, of course, is another matter, isn't it?
That's absolutely correct. So this energy inefficiency in complex 5 could be caused by something else, and we don't know what. That's got to be the subject of future research, but at least we've narrowed it down to that protein and the other things that can be a consequence of that, with this turning up of all the energy production pathways.
Is there much research into it? I know in some other areas of, you know, that are large and complex and with diffuse seemingly causes, that can be hard to focus research because people don't really know what they're looking for.
There's been small amounts of research in a variety of different areas is the best way to describe it. And it's accelerating over the last 5 to 10 years, I have to say, as people have become more cognizant of the fact that this is a biomedical disorder. It's not a psychological disorder.
Yeah.
Yes, so exactly. It's accelerating.
Craig wants to know, he says, can you please ask the team, actually this is a chestnut which I really should put to you, can you please ask the team, if it's true that people get chronic fatigue syndrome after having glandular fever, is there an association, Paul?
It's a common experience, but it doesn't have to be glandular fever. So what we have found from talking to patients and so on is that sometimes it's glandular fever, but it could be another infection, or it could be some sort of other overexertion in the patient's life that kicks it off. It is common for an infection to start it off, and so people did look for viruses as well.
One of my texters says their son has had it for 11 years, devastated the family, and it started with him catching chickenpox.
Mm. Yep, that would be the sort of thing that can kick it off. So it doesn't have to be glandular fever. It can be a variety of other infections. I spoke to one patient who had a diarrheal infection, so not even
a gut infection.
A gut infection, and that kicked it off for them. So it varies from individual to individual.
Yeah. Does it run in families? Is there a genetic link?
There seems to be a genetic link. It's not as simple as a single gene, though. But you can see that in families there is a greater risk, and it's about if you have a first order relative, so that's mums and dads, children and brothers and sisters, who has chronic fatigue syndrome, your risks are about 2 times higher than they are for the rest of the population.
Right, and you mentioned this because I did want to put this to you, because this is another one, isn't it? That a common belief about the condition is that chronic fatigue syndrome is that it's all in your head. In other words, it's a psychological condition, and we can put this to bed, can we? There's no evidence for that, or it's just not true?
There's no evidence for it, except that chronic fatigue patients, naturally, who've got this undiagnosable, untreatable disease for really long periods of time, are going to face obstacles in their life that can lead to depression. So it's common for depression to be a consequence of the disease, but it's not a cause. And so I think we can put to bed the idea that it's a psychological disorder. It's actually held up research because people have thought that it's a it's a psychological disorder, and therefore you can't do biomedical research on it.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Now, Heidi, sorry.
Yeah, and I think that there's also something to be said for this back onto the idea of diagnosis and the criteria that's needed for the tight diagnostic criteria for ME/CFS. So what has been a problem in the past is that there have been much looser diagnostic criteria, and that's where you end up with people being put into this category who really shouldn't be there in the first place. So if you have the looser definition, which doesn't require post-exertional malaise, of course you're going to end up with lots of people that do have depression or anxiety or things that are just very separate to the sorts of patients that we're talking about, which again is why it's really important that doctors get to grips with the new diagnostic criteria.
Yes, that's absolutely true.
And I can imagine that depression and anxiety would be concomitant symptoms because there's a lot to be unhappy about.
But what we do find from patients is one of the things that we always sort of refer back to is that if you talk to a patient who is depressed and you say, look, if you felt better tomorrow, what would you do? The depressed patient is going to find it really hard to actually kind of verbalize and think through, well, what would I do? Well, I don't really, you know, what would tomorrow look like? Because they've got depression, right? Whereas if you ask people, even if they're really severely unwell with ME/CFS, the patients that are, you know, particularly if they're bedbound or housebound, and if you say to those patients, look, if you woke up tomorrow and you were better, they have a laundry list. They will tell you all of the things that they've been missing out on doing and all of the things that they'd go and do. And I think that's a very sort of defining feature of how this illness, it really does have a biomedical origin.
Yeah. One of my texters says, the problem with the term chronic fatigue is that fatigue does not describe the all-encompassing exhaustion faced daily by sufferers. People hear chronic fatigue and think, oh, they're feeling tired.
Yeah, it's a
terrible
name.
It's not like that, is it, Fiona?
Yeah. No, it's much worse than that. But it is hard. I think that the English language is a little bit deficit in this because all the words that we might otherwise use to describe how sick we feel are words that otherwise healthy people would use to describe themselves being just kind of really worn out. So there are words like fatigue and like tired and like unable to concentrate and like, you know, I need to go to bed. And there are all these expressions, but for us, they're a symptom. They're massively more significant. They're massively more than, and they go on and they go on and they go on. This is not just, you know, a flu that you feel really bad in your bedbound for 2 weeks. This is a flu that you have and you feel terrible, and it goes on for months, and it goes on for years, and it goes on for years. And so it's very different. It's very important to point out that it is hard to explain to people because we literally don't have the words for it, I think.
When you're in bed, when you have to go to bed, do you sleep or what do you do?
I just sleep a bit. I have a sleeping disorder as well, and that's not uncommon with people with chronic fatigue syndrome. But also, for me, it's a lot about rest. And yet not able to concentrate on reading, even though I really love reading. So I do it if I can. I listen to the radio, a lot during the day. And I watch a lot of Netflix and SBS on demand, to be honest. You should employ me as a reviewer because I'm really, really, I've seen everything. But it's a lot of resting. And there would be times last weekend I slept for 16 hours one of the nights. So there'll be times when I'm just look sort of normal, and then obviously my body just goes, nah, I've just got to shut down. My record is 20 hours. I did that a few months ago in one night. It just, like, a whole day of my life just went past. I don't know what happened.
Heidi, what treatments are there? I mean, are there any treatments?
Okay, so in terms of treatments, there is nothing that is effective. There is nothing that is effective for everyone. So that's the first thing to say. But there are things that patients can do and that doctors can do with patients to improve the quality of life. The main things are rest, and then something called pacing, and then something called stepwise symptom management. So in terms of rest, it's what Fiona was just describing, but for patients who are more severely unwell, even something like watching one episode of Netflix might put them into post-exertional malaise. It might be too much for them, the cognitive exertion that's required for listening to the radio or for watching TV can be too much for some patients. So what we do recommend is resting and finding what is truly restful for that patient. So it might just be sitting and having all stimulation off for a lot of patients. And of course, for some patients, or this sleep problems are very common. And with some patients, they might be sleeping for 16 or 20 hours and waking up and still feeling terrible. Mm-hmm. And for other patients, they may just be completely unable to sleep and still feel terrible. So the sleeping problems are very significant, but rest and resting as much as people can when they can. Pacing is about looking at activities and saying, I can do this much and then I need to stop and I need to rest. We have this idea of usable hours in the day, so it can be helpful for patients to say, I, at best, maybe I've got 4 usable hours, or maybe at best at the moment when I'm in a worse time of my condition, I might only have 30 minutes or 1 hour of usable time in the day. And then they have to work out what they can do with those usable hours and make sure that they rest between each activity that they do. So for some patients, just showering, I was talking to a patient recently, and they can shower maybe once a week or once a fortnight, or they can only wash their hair with help once a fortnight because they just can't do those kinds of activities.
Mm. Yeah, all right. Fiona, having kids is exhausting. Anybody who's had kids knows this.
Mm.
It's tough for you.
Yeah, yes, it was. It was extremely hard.
I don't mean birthing them. I mean looking after them.
Yeah. Both, actually. Yeah. No, looking after them. Yes, very much. They were 3 easy children, basically. Mm. If I'd had one demanding child, I would have had one child, basically, because I wouldn't have been able to cope. But I was very sick. I was very careful about what I could do. And it's exactly what Heidi said. You've got limited amount of energy and you just have to, like, everything's a risk assessment. Everything's kind of, okay, if I do that, then I can't do this. And if I want to do that in 2 days, I can't do this for the next 2 days. You have to think everything out very, very carefully. And that was very much true when they were small. But it's even true now. They're teenagers and instead of, you know, needing to be picked up and carried places, I have to deal with more dramatic things.
Sure.
So that's not much easier. Yeah.
What treatments have you tried? I bet you've tried everything, have you?
Oh, because it's so long.
From Chinese medicine
because it's so long. I mean, I've tried naturopathic help and I've tried Chinese medicine and they're probably the main ones that I tried over the years. I did it for a lot when I was the first sort of 15 years or so that I was sick, and then I just got over it, frankly. And you just realise that you don't have much energy and you'd rather use it in more positive ways.
Nothing
worked. The Chinese medicine, I don't quite understand why, but it made me feel better for about 2 weeks. Like, not well, but just a bit better.
Mm-hmm.
I still don't know why. Basically, someone gave me such a vicious massage, it was like getting beaten up, and I felt better afterwards. Never quite understood that one. But I also sat in a drip with vitamin C treatment. I meant sitting on a drip once a week for massive amounts.
Have you had the ice bath treatment?
No, I never did. That was a bit of a 90s thing. That's one of the ones that came and went where you had to sit in an ice bath.
You had to sit in an ice bath for
Actually submerged in ice in an ice bath. So there was some theory about bringing your temperature down. I think what I mean is I tried a whole lot of stuff and then I thought, I just want someone, until someone can give me a really good chance of it actually making a difference, I'm not going to put myself and us financially through that.
Mm. Just back to you, Paul. Given that we understand what is happening at a cellular level in relation to fatigue, that's different from, say, what's causing it. Does this sort of provide a promising pathway to saying, look, if we know what's happening to the cells that's causing the fatigue, we might have some way of influencing their cell chemistry to do something else?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, by a drug, for example.
Absolutely, that's the hope. But we don't understand everything yet. Cells are really complicated and we are just beginning in this journey of trying to understand what's happening. Just to give you a feeling for it, there are this one protein that I mentioned before probably has interactions and connections to 50 or 100 others, and each of them has interactions and connections with 50 or 100 others. So you've got this big network of things to sort out and dissect and try to figure out what goes wrong. You know, you tweak one part of the network and something happens somewhere else.
Mm. Yes, we're talking about chronic fatigue syndrome with Dr. Heidi Nickel, who's Chief Executive Officer at Emerge Australia, Fiona Cheng, who's has the condition, and Professor Paul Fisher, Head of Microbiology at La Trobe University, who's conducting important research into the condition as well. John joins us online. Hi, John.
Hi, Phil. How are you?
Not bad. Your daughter suffers.
Yeah, she's She's 17, and she would fit the severe category. So she's been sick for 4 years now.
Right.
And she's been completely bedbound for the last two.
Yeah. Do you have you had problems from those around you who don't understand very well what's happening?
No, we're probably one of the lucky ones in the respect that we've got a very large support network.
Right.
So people do understand what's happened, but I think the hardest thing for us was that Ella started to get sick gradually, and no one could really tell us what was wrong. So probably like a lot of patients, we went and saw, I think, nearly 25 doctors in the end. And it was tending to be us that actually said to the doctors, well, you know, what about myalgic encephalomyelitis? Do you think that's what it could be?
Mm.
And we had one endocrinologist at the hospital say, oh, no, she's far too sick for that. But she's now completely bedbound. She finished school halfway through year 10, so she should be doing HSC at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, she's completely bedbound, and, you know, all she can do is walk to the toilet and back a few times a day.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think Heidi was talking about the post-exertional malaise. Ella's in bed full-time, but she actually can't watch TV, read a book. She tends to get a lot of brain swelling, and she actually can't do anything to entertain herself, so she tends to just lie there all day,
well,
which is extremely hard.
Devastating. For everyone concerned. Thanks, John. Thanks for sharing that with us. It's, yeah, I mean, you would have, this would be very familiar to you, Heidi.
Yeah, I think that particularly the issue that John's brought up about younger people who, you know, are, you know, younger people and also the people who are so severely unwell. So I think there's two issues with that. One is that schools don't know enough about this condition.
No.
And, you know, as John said, going to 25 doctors, it's just not good enough. Doctors need to know more about, you know, about the condition. But also people are not getting enough help with their schools. They're not getting enough help with their schooling. And of course, when people are so severely unwell, we just need money for research. We need more funding. We need to know what's happening.
I can imagine you have put us in touch with the frustration, you too, Fiona, the frustration, though, which you must feel, because normally if you have interactions with a medical profession, you've got at least something to cling to. You've got a prescription or you've got something that, you know, may alleviate or ameliorate symptoms. And in this instance, there isn't anything.
So the one thing that doctors can do, and it's really not helpful in the situation such as Ella's, who are so severely unwell, but for people that are sort of moderate, you know, on the more moderate categories, there is something called stepwise symptom management. And that's something that if doctors know about it, it can help to alleviate some of the symptoms. So what we're talking about is going at the symptoms and using things that are in the usual doctor's toolkit to treat the worst symptoms in order to try and gain some quality of life for the patient. So let's say if sleeping is the worst problem, then they can try and prescribe sleep medications and they can try and advise on sleep hygiene and, you know, just try everything that they've got to go at the worst symptom. Then the next worst symptom might be pain. So there are lots of things that you can try for pain management. Not all of them will work. Patients might have medication sensitivities, etc., that you have to work around. But doctors can work their way through all of the worst symptoms. And we've just developed some GP education that I was talking about before. So it's on Think GP, and all of that information is there for doctors so that they can work out the latest diagnostic criteria. They can look through the best evidence at the moment that's sort of in line with international guidance.
Jane, hi.
Oh, hi. Hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hi, Phil. Speaker. Good evening to all your guests. I've known four people who had chronic fatigue syndrome, I've known five, and four of them were women. Is it more common among women?
I don't know. Is it, Paul?
Yes, it's about 75% to 80% women.
Oh, really? That high?
Oh, okay. That high.
Yeah.
That's amazing. But one of them.
Do we know why? Sorry, Jenny. Do we know why, Paul?
No, we don't. It may be that there's an autoimmune dimension to this disease because women are more prone to autoimmune diseases as well.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't really know why.
Sorry, Jenny.
No, and one of them, she used to work at the ABC actually, when she was very, very sick for quite a few years. And when she had a baby, it all went. That was amazing.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I'm getting a little bit of this on the text line too, that certain life events can make it go away. Heidi, is it a life sentence or not? Or can it just suddenly resolve itself?
So it's a really difficult question. And what we really where we stand on this is that we are really most concerned about the people for whom nothing works.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult, again, with these diagnostic criteria and with the lack of some definitive blood tests to say what did people have in the first place. So what we do know is that when we use the tight diagnostic criteria, we have post-exertional malaise as the cardinal symptom. And when we look at that cohort of people, there are people who do not get better.
Hmm. Heather in Bendigo says, hi, Phil and guests. My chronic fatigue went away after I had my tonsils taken out at age 50. Now, Paul, is there any medical evidence that links any of these kind of events, childbirth, tonsils taken out, et cetera, with the cessation of the symptoms?
I find them as difficult to understand as you do. I'm not a medico.
We're talking about coincidence here, are we? Perhaps not, rather than causation.
I think the difficulty is knowing what people have in the first place. And I think that's why we need more research and we need to get towards a diagnostic test. And we just need to find out what's actually happening. But it is very difficult to talk. I mean, we want to balance hope. Mm. So we don't want to say that it's a life sentence and people are never going to get better. But the lived reality for many, many people is that this is something that they are living with permanently.
Sure. What do you think, Fiona? I mean, do you live in hope that you'll get better? Or do you you accept that you're not, that this is going to be, this is what you're, this is how your life is going to roll?
I think having had it for such a long time, I think I've kind of had to accept it, that it is for the foreseeable future. If I woke up tomorrow and felt spectacular and felt well, I'd be really happy about it. But I think it would actually be unwise to do that, to expect that.
Mm. No, that's what I'm thinking. Yeah, just what the state of mind is.
Yeah. And I think also too, it's interesting talking to people who are more newly diagnosed and who are younger, had it for a shorter time than me. They're often sort of desperate to find a cure, and I completely understand that. But I also feel like for me, a kind of better quality of life came when I sort of accepted it to some a lot more. And so that's why now I'm in management phase, where I am realistic about what I can and can't do, and I've brought everything down and down. But that's a really hard point to get to, and it's only after having times when I have been unable to do almost anything that to this now feels pretty good, because I can do some things and I can actually come on something like this and talk with you, whereas the people who are really ill can't. So you're only ever going to talk to the people who are moderate, because really ill ones will never be able to make it into the studio.
Yeah, no, fair enough. Andrew?
Yes?
Hi. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Sorry, Andrew, you're on. Do you want to ask a question?
Yeah, sure. I just wanted to ask how we could help patients that are going through possibly the medical abuse through doing graded exercise therapy and CBT, that patients are experiencing, because there just seems to be nowhere where we can get any help or turn to when we're placed in these situations.
All right, Heidi, any comment here?
So graded exercise therapy is, there's a sort of long, sorry, complex history about graded exercise therapy with patients with chronic fatigue syndrome. And I feel like I'm banging on to the same thing, but really, again, it's linked to poorly diagnosed cohorts of patients. So there is evidence that exercise is helpful for people who have depression and anxiety. Mm-hmm. And if you don't get a tight enough diagnosis and a tight enough cohort of people to correctly diagnose ME/CFS, and if you have all of the patients with depression or anxiety mixed in there, then of course a proportion of them will do better with exercise. So what we find is that if it's correctly diagnosed, then there's no way that graded exercise therapy is going to be helpful for patients, because we know the primary symptom is feeling worse after you do activity.
As we've been describing. So exercise is actually the worst thing you could possibly be doing.
It's the worst thing. And it's been removed as a recommendation by the Center for Disease Control in America.
Uh-huh.
So the GP education that we've developed is really looking at these other ways of managing, which is really rest, it's pacing, and it's stepwise symptom management by discussing with the doctor.
Hmm. But there are a lot of doctors who still suggest that, and I've had
a friend,
and who say that that's still, because for a long time there was a theory that was actually very helpful, and some incredible damage has been done in some people's lives through that, and I've known people who that has happened to.
Hmm. Paul, go on, Paul.
Sorry, I was going to say part of the problem there is that it's still part of the guidelines for medical practitioners in Australia, and we think it needs to be removed.
Mm. Who tell patients, look, why don't you try and get out and do some exercise? You'll feel better.
Mm. That's not what we want to hear.
Okay. All right, Paul, tell us about, and Heidi, chime in here too, because I know you're involved with the project as well. Tell us about the Biobank project and what you think, or how will this help?
So the Biobank project has two parts. One part is the biobank itself, which is led by Heidi, and the other part, which is a science project coupled to that, which I lead. So I can tell you about the science part of it.
Mm.
The basic idea is of a biobank is that you'll have a large number of samples and patient information that can provide a resource for researchers to get samples and to try to study what's going on and figure out what's going on in this disease. And this will be blood samples in this case, and the blood will be separated into two parts, into plasma and into the white blood cells, which are the cells that we've been working on.
Mm. Heidi?
Yeah, and from our part, we are enrolling patients. So we're looking for patients who are willing to donate their blood or their tissue, and also just patients that would be willing to be contacted for the possibility of doing research with us, and they can find the details on the Emerge Australia website. Mm.
And Paul, this basically gives you a large amount of material to work with, is it? Does it? Or a way to see what commonalities or what common things there are, or to explore theories?
Yes. So, for example, for the initial project that we're doing, we're asking the question, are the different categories of patients, do they show the same pattern of abnormalities that we see in blood? So the categories that we're looking at are going to be patients where the primary co-symptom that they have with chronic fatigue syndrome or myalgic encephalomyelitis is pain, so fibromyalgia.
Mm.
We want to compare patients in the severe group who are house or bedbound with patients who have it not quite so severely, so that we can see if the same underlying processes are happening.
Mm.
And we'll have a paediatric cohort where a small paediatric cohort where patients are under the age of 18 and have been diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome as well.
Sue from Canberra is one of the. We're getting quite a few texts along this line, but I think we have put this one to bed. But just to return to it, Sue from Canberra says, I'm a psychologist and I work with a lot of clients with chronic fatigue syndrome. Many of them have family backgrounds involving some kind of childhood trauma or abuse. Is there? But I think we've discussed this, haven't we? That may well be true, Sue, but there isn't any evidence that the two things are linked, is there?
Yeah, right? Exactly. And again, I think that if you look at post-exertional malaise as the central feature, and we look at all of this increasing biomedical evidence that is, you know, coming out from around all around the world, then I think that there may be coincidences in there, but it's not a psychological disorder.
No. Jackie, hello.
Hello.
Hi, Jackie.
Hello, how are you going?
Well, Jackie, you've had it for 24 years.
I have, and it took 5 years for me to get a diagnosis.
Mm.
I was put on all sorts of, I was put on antidepressants, even though I wasn't depressed. I was put on HRT, even though I was only 38. Everything they put me on made me ill. It was eventually a naturopath that diagnosed me. And then I went back to my doctor and said, well, this is what they think I have, and they called it chronic fatigue syndrome, which I don't like using that because I think it trivialises a very serious disease.
Mm-hmm.
I do prefer calling it myalgic encephalomyelitis because I think, you know, I feel I definitely have brain inflammation, constant headaches, plus all the other symptoms that most of us get. But the one point I did want to make is that the lack of research funds worldwide, but here in Australia, we've recently been told that $3 million will be put towards ME research, which is wonderful as a start. But we definitely need more. I mean, this is far more common than MS. I think there's about 2.5 million people worldwide with MS, and anything from 17 to 30 million people with ME, and I think approximately 250,000 people in Australia have ME. As opposed, and I'm not dissing on anyone with MS. They need their research funds too, but what I'm saying is, you know, a lot less people have MS than have ME, and yet they get a reasonable amount of funds. We don't get a lot.
I know. Fair enough, and I can't imagine people would be disagreeing with you. I can't imagine, Heidi, you'd be disagreeing here.
Yeah, no. I mean, I've got some figures on this, you know, down here. So I think that over the last 16 to 20 years, the Australian government was putting in $100,000 a year for myalgic encephalomyelitis research. Our estimates of how much the disease costs the Australian state, and in comparison with spending on other illnesses, we reckon we should have something more like $7 million a year. So as Jackie was saying, it was great. We were really pleased that there was an announcement of $3 million a year. The announcement came out in March of this year. We haven't actually seen the funding yet, and obviously we want that funding to go to biomedical research. But really, we should be getting $7 million, $10 million a year. So we need an increase in funding, and we need it directed towards biomedical research.
Paul, if you had more money, what would... because I know sometimes with fundamental research, you think, well, even if I had more money, I'm not necessarily sure what I would be doing with it. Do you, or I mean, I guess, is it a given that, you know, that more money for research would necessarily produce more good?
Oh, absolutely. I have... a whole grand scheme of things that we could do if we had more funding. Okay. So it's, you're limited only by your imagination, and mostly research is limited by the funding, not by the imagination. Yeah. So,
yes, no, you're right, Heidi, in pointing to that's right, the economic cost of all these things, which I think sometimes we put to one side.
I should also say there's great research happening in Australia. We have got groups looking at metabolic defects. We have got people looking at dysfunction on a cellular level. We have got groups looking at defects in iron transport. We have got some really world quality research here in Australia. We just need people to put the money in.
What's your gut feeling, Paul? What do you think? What do you? Well, I mean, maybe this is not a fair question to ask a scientist, but what do you think is the cause of it?
Honestly, I don't know what the primary cause is. I think there's going to be immunological involvement. There's going to be genetic involvement. There's going to be gut involvement because the gut microbiome is changed. There's going to be mitochondrial involvement, like we have seen, energy metabolism involvement, right. And they're all interconnected. So I don't know what the primary cause is going to be, but I am confident that as we understand more, we've got a much better chance of designing decent treatments. And I think also we're very close to getting diagnostic tests as well.
Heidi, just before you go, what's the best way to support people you know who've got it?
Believe them. Yeah. Believe them that they're sick. That's my number one thing. Believe them. Reduce the stigma.
Well, look, good on you, all of you. And Fiona, I'm in awe of your effort too in coming here and speaking to us tonight and giving us a first-hand impression of what life is like for someone with the condition. Fiona Cheng has ME-CFS, has had it since the 1980s, and it's been her life. Thank you for coming in. Heidi, thank you for coming in as well. Dr. Heidi Nicholas, the Chief Executive Officer at Emerge Australia, which is a CFS charity. And Professor Paul Fisher, a scientist, head of microbiology at La Trobe University in Melbourne. Paul, thank you for your time as well.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, no, thanks to all of you too. And thank you for the many texts and calls we had too. And I'm sorry we couldn't get to everyone, but I hope we did share. Look, it's not in your head, okay? It's an actual condition. And as Heidi says, if you know people, believe them.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.